Tonight on Arena, we look at the winners and losers on today's Booker Prize long list, and writer and actor Michael Patrick on his play about Irish revolutionary Sean Moylan. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Original and thrilling is how the panel of judges described the 13 novels they have shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. The panel read 163 novels across 7 months, and in the process of whittling down to the final 13, announced this morning with a shortlist of 6 books to be announced on September the 21st, the winner then on November the 26th. Prize is open to any book written in English, which is published in the UK. So you can have people from America, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Nigeria, as long as the book is written in English and published in the UK. Extraordinary, then, I think it is safe to say that 1/3 of this year's nominees are Irish writers, some of whom we have been delighted to interview here on the programme over the past 12 months. John Self joins me. He's had a few hours now to digest the list. John, your initial reaction, because I was looking at some of your tweets today. You were very busy on the Twitter machine, as they say. Your initial reaction when you looked at the 13?
My initial reaction was pretty positive. You know, I thought it's a solid list. And I say that because I've read 5 of the novels on it. And I loved some of them, liked them all to some degree or another. So, you know, one could have quibbles about ones that you would have liked to see on there as well. But the ones I've read, I think they're good. And, you know, I can't assume the others aren't.
However, let us talk about the big note, I suppose, for all of us here, is the fact that there are 4 of these 13 novelists that are Irish writers. That is an extraordinary statistic, almost a third. If you could have 4 1/3 writers, we'd be there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's extraordinary, and it's the highest number of Irish writers that have ever been longlisted for the award. And if you think about the fact that since the last 10 years or so, America has been included as well. So as you said at the top, you know, any country in the world, as long as the book is written in English. So for all of them, 4 of them to come from Ireland is just a huge vote of confidence in the continued quality and significance of Irish writing.
Let's talk about the specifics of those Irish books, and then we'll look at the list in a broader way as well. First of all, Sebastian Barry and Old God's Time. 5 times nominated, Sebastian Barry, for the Booker Prize and not a winner yet. Yeah. Could this be his year?
It could be a bit of a Booker bridesmaid, is Barry, you know, and he's come close. He almost won it in 2008 with The Secret Scripture, came second, but I think, you know, this is a really interesting book for him because he's been seen as quite a sort of a lyrical writer. You know, lots of beautiful sentences. Then his last couple, the ones set in the American West, were a bit more plot heavy, a bit more page turnery. And this one is kind of interesting because it kind of combines the two, you know. It's very beautifully written, but there's also, it gets quite tense, quite dramatic. There's a lot of stuff going on in the last 100 pages. So I think this could be a very interesting one for him.
Yeah, in fact, I spoke to Sebastian Barry about this novel, an Arena Special. We had a public interview with him on February the 21st of this year in front of a live audience at the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire. And, you know, as you've touched on there, there are great darknesses in this book, and maybe something that we don't necessarily associate with the writing of Sebastian Barry. So here he is telling us a little bit about it and what pushed him in that direction, dealing with the two characters, Don Kettle and his wife Jean, who have had suffered terrible abuse as children and despite everything have made it into adulthood and made good lives for themselves. Here's Sebastian speaking about the novel.
I think it's the victory that these two people who have endured what so many people had to endure in that Ireland, I don't know, maybe there's scrapes of it still, that they have been able to find each other and at least make the attempt, in particular not to pass on the things that have happened to them, and to love their babies in the ordinary way that people do, and read the stories to them, and be true to them, and stand by them, and try to protect them. They've done all those things. But the fact is, I mean, one of the, you know, the darker hearts, as you say, almost the bloodless heart through which nothing moves, is what happened to them. And, you know, if there's any secret purpose in the mathematics of the book, in the strange calculus of the book, it's to insist in a way that the problem with what we call almost cloakingly clerical abuse or abuse or neglectful nuns or the rest of it is that there's nothing really in the statute books, to my mind, that properly covers the crime.
That's Sebastian Barry speaking to me in February of this year at a public interview in and around the time of the publication of his book, Old God's Time, which has been long listed for this year's Booker Prize. And John Self has been looking at the long list for us. It's one of the four, and I suppose he is undoubtedly the most established and the elder statesman in terms of Irish writing of the other four. Elaine Feeney for How to Build a Novel, Paul Lynch for Prophet Song, and Paul Murray for the Bee Sing. I think you were particularly taken by the fact that Paul Murray is on there, John.
I was, yes. I mean, that's a tremendous novel. It's Paul Murray, he takes a long time to write his novels. They're big novels. It's 600 odd pages, but I read it over a long weekend. I just couldn't stop reading it. It's a wonderful, funny, sad story about an Irish rural family who run this secondhand car business, and the kids want to get into Dublin, and the parents are trying to get away from their past and into the future. And it's just absolutely wonderful. Each of the characters talks to us directly. It's full of heart. It's full of life. It's sort of a book that you can just imagine you sort of becoming a favourite and a bit of a friend to you.
And a lot of praise for Elaine Feeney and her book How to Build a Boat at the time of its publication, and Paul Lynch with Prophet Song, also a writer who has been working solidly away, you know, with reasonable success for quite a period of time now. Any of those four novels, are they contenders for certainly the shortlist, whatever about the final prize?
I think most definitely. I haven't read Elaine Feeney's or Paul Lynch's. Paul Lynch's isn't out yet, but certainly the Paul Murray and Sebastian Barry would be very, very surprised if not to see at least one of those on the shortlist, and it could even go further. You know, these are books that they have to appeal to a range of panel of judges, you know, with differing opinions, and I think they've both got a very broad appeal.
All right. However, if it were up to you, there'd have been more than just a third of the long list being Irish authors. You were particularly disappointed, I think, for Claire Kilroy.
I was indeed. I was borderline outraged. You know, I mean, this is a novel. This is her novel, Soldier Sailor, her first novel in 11 years. It's an absolute bomb of a novel. It's a novel about a woman who's just become a mother. And, you know, it takes rather well written about material and makes it absolutely explosive. It's wonderful. It's so lively. And I'm not just the only person saying that, because it's been absolutely universally praised and revered and acclaimed everywhere it's been talked about. So it was a real, real shock not to see that one on the long list.
Yeah, so you were disappointed about that. And I know you also tweeted at one point today that Anne Enright's The Wren, and Megan Nolan's Ordinary Human Failings, they were missed out for you. But let us look at the other nine novels that did make it to this long list. Four debut novelists in the midst of that, Jonathan Coffery, Sian Hughes, Victoria Lloyd Barlow and Chetna Maru. That is a big thing. I don't know how familiar you are with any of the four of those writers, but that is a big thing for a debut novelist to make the Booker long list. That really shoves them up the pecking order quite a bit, doesn't it?
It does shove them up the pecking order, and it's a double-edged sword, because it can, you know, if a debut novelist to win the Booker Prize, it puts them a lot of pressure on them, gives them a lot of, you know, maybe they're still doing their growing up as a writer, and they have to do that in public all of a sudden. One of the four debuts I've read is Western Lane by Chetna Maru, which is a novel about squash, the game. You know, I don't think we've had a novel about squash before. It's a really interesting book, very good, and quite interesting in that a lot of young novelists try to put everything into their first book, and she has actually taken almost everything out except what needs to be there. It's quite short, very sharp, really interesting book. So, you know, good luck to those debutantes as well.
Yeah, and in terms of what's left then on the remainder of the list, what stood out for you, or what were the connections that you made with the books that did make it, the remaining books that made it to the list, John?
Well, the other two that I've read on the list were Tan Tuan Eng's The House of Doors, which is a book about the novelist Somerset Maugham and his time in Malaysia in the 1920s. And again, this is Tan's third novel, his third time being on the Booker long list or short list. And it's a very satisfying, quite a slightly old-fashioned novel, the kind of book you could see winning the Booker maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Will it go further? I don't know, but it's a very assured performance. And the other one is Martin McGuinness's In Ascension, which is I suppose you could really call it a sort of a science fiction novel. Mm. It's about a young woman who's a scientist, and she goes deep sea exploring, and then over the course of the novel, she ends up traveling into space on this sort of intergalactic mission, using all these sorts of new science that's been discovered. And it's quite a slow moving book, but it's all very persuasive and very interesting. And it kind of takes you, if like me, you don't read a lot of science fiction, kind of takes you to somewhere that you didn't know you were going, and in a very interesting and satisfying way. So that's definitely one to watch too.
Yeah, and I think just to complete the list out then, and these are the remaining books, Ayobami Adebayo and a book called A Spell of Good Things, Sarah Bernstein with Study for Obedience, and Paul Harding would be the other one that we haven't mentioned yet, This Other Eden. There were other disappointments for you outside of the Irish writers that you've mentioned as well, John, that haven't made the list.
Yeah, there were. I mean, I mentioned it earlier that there aren't that many Americans on the list this year. And one American that I think could have been on the list is Elizabeth McCracken, a novelist who's been writing for a couple of decades now. Mm. Her novel, The Hero of This Book, which is kind of like a novel about her mother, or about a fictionalized version of her mother, which is a beautiful, wonderful sort of act of remembrance and grief and humor and all about the wonderful things that families do together. So that was one that was disappointing. A new novel about to come out called A Carrot by Adam Mars Jones, which I just read last week, a very big book about a man living in 1970s England who's got all sorts of challenges in his life, but he's very funny and interesting and so on. So yeah, there are other ones that I would like to see on there. But again, I can't complain about the ones that I've read. There.
I know you mentioned Barbara Kingsolver as well and Damon Copperhead. I wondered, I suppose it's kind of taking the David Copperfield story and using it. Was that part of the reason that it didn't make it to the list? Was it maybe not considered a totally original work, even though she would quite definitely argue it is?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it is a very good book, you know, and there is the fact that she's basically riffing on David Copperfield. But the other thing is, of course, I mean, let's say the judges had to choose between that and one of the debuts on the list. Well, yeah. You know, Barbara Kingsolver, she's won the Pulitzer. She's been shortlisted for the Women's Prize as well. You know, so maybe they'll give the chance to someone else instead.
Yeah. And I think you would agree that the judges here are well placed to do so. Robert Webb, actor and comedian, Mary Jean Chan, a poet, James Shapiro, history and literature professor, Adju Ando, the actor, and S.A. Dugan, the Canadian novelist and chair of the panel. These are people who have read widely and will have strong opinions. And I guess there only can be 13.
Well, exactly, you know, and you know, so you know, you can't trump personal opinion at the end of the day, and a different panel of five judges would have produced 13 different, probably with some overlaps.
Yeah.
But with five judges, you get a good range of tastes and a good degree of consensus, I think.
One final question. You did say, John, that it was a traditional list. Is that a kind of a put-down of the list overall, or is that a positive?
Not really, because if you see some of the more outlandish, if you like, lists we've seen recently. Yeah, in 2020, there were, I think, 11 debuts out of 13 novels on the list, you know, so it's much more traditional in the sense that, you know, there aren't that many Americans on it because they weren't eligible until recently. There's a couple of little surprises there with books that no one had read or heard of, but a couple of familiar names for people to sort of grab onto and recognise in the bookshop. So I think, I didn't mean it as a put down, it's an interesting list.
An interesting list is what you're saying. Thanks to John Self for taking us through the long list for this year's Booker Prize. 13 novels in total. Congratulations in particular to the four Irish authors on that list. Sebastian Barry, Elaine Feeney, Paul Lynch and Paul Murray. The Booker shortlist of six books will be announced on September the 21st, and the winner will then be revealed on November the 26th, receiving a prize of £50,000 sterling. Now, chances are the last time you saw the actor Michael Patrick, he was on screen playing the taciturn father in On Colleen Kuhn, the Irish film we went to see in our droves last year and that gave us such joy when it was shortlisted for an Oscar. Michael is now on tour with his own one-man show, Sean Moylan, an Irish revolutionary, about the Cork man who was one of the military leaders in the War of Independence and more reluctantly in the Civil War. Michael Patrick joins me now on the line from Whiddy Island in Cork, where he's about to go on stage. Did I say Cork man? I think Limerick man is probably fairer in terms of Sean Moylan. Is it? Would I be right? Which would you say, Michael?
Both, I guess. He was born in Kilmallock, County Limerick. His father was from Newmarket in County Cork, and his parents were living in Newmarket in County Cork. But as was common at the time, his mother went to her parents' house to have her children, and he stayed with his grandparents in Kilmallock for quite a lot of his childhood, and he was back and forth.
So we'll keep everybody happy by saying he's from both places. I will come back undoubtedly to Sean Moylan, an Irish revolutionary, but I did mention on Colleen Kuhn there, and I was just thinking, you know, there I was before the break speaking about the number of Irish writers that are on this year's Booker Prize long list. And here we are now, or here we were back then at the time of the Oscars, talking about the number of Irish nominations there. What are your memories of that period of time and the actual, that moment when, first of all, you knew it, that you were going to the Oscars, and then getting there and the experience of being there with the film?
The BAFTA thing happened first, so we kind of had a lead into the Oscars. Obviously, you never expected when you're making the film, and we made it during the peak of COVID between the first and second lockdowns. It was a positive experience, and we all thought we had something special, but we could never predict where it was going to go. And then the Oscar announcement, our film was the last nominee called out in our category, and it was nerve-wracking and nail-biting, and that probably made it even more exciting and sweeter when it was finally announced. And then getting there was great. It felt like being part of Team Ireland, or the closest I'll ever get to it anyway, because there were so many Irish nominees on the flight over there, and so many Irish people in general at the Oscars and the Oscars events that were happening in the days before.
The character that you had to play in On Colleen Kuhn, rather, I said taciturn in my introduction. There are other words I could use from him. He was quite nasty at times too, if you don't mind my saying that, of a character that you had to play. I believe this got you into some kinds of scrapes sometimes in supermarkets and places like that.
Yeah, I don't know why it's supermarkets specifically, but that seems to be the case. Yeah. one American reviewer described him as a pig. I don't argue with any of that. And I think he, like his own children, is a victim of his own upbringing and his own environment, and that he was never showed love. So therefore, he can't display affection or love. And it's a vicious cycle. And if Koch didn't meet the Kinselas, maybe she would carry on the cycle. But the optimism and the hope is that because she's been shown that love and affection and understands that it's out there, that will break the cycle for her, at least.
Yeah, and I guess that's what you have to do as an actor when you're looking at a part, particularly like the part of the father in On Colleen Kuhn. You have to look for the reasons that maybe he behaves in the way he does, and not judge him for his behaviour, but find the reasons behind it.
Yeah, exactly. And well, I've felt slightly differently about this character because I think he does judge himself. I think he knows that he should be doing better and he wants to do better, but he can't because he's stuck. And he feels the outside judgment, and the more he feels that outside judgment, the more stubborn he becomes, and the more he doubles down on the vices that are the negative forces in his life. So I think his biggest issue actually is his own judgment of himself.
Yeah, so he's hard on himself. One final thing on it, and I promise I will talk about Sean Moylan in a minute, but one final thing, it did strike me, one of the real strengths of the film in terms of the way the language was used, obviously the majority of the film was Oscaliga, but your character and that family spoke English, and it really did remove them out from the rest of the community of the film, which I thought was a very clever way of showing that.
Yeah, I agree. I had read Clare Keegan's Foster, which obviously I loved, and then Colm Braid sent his adaptation, and the first thing I noticed was that my character didn't speak any Gaelic, not a word, even though his children speak Irish, his wife speaks Irish, he has to understand it. It's inevitable that he's picked it up, but he's just made that stubborn decision that he's not going to, and that informed me about who he was straight away. And I agree. It's a really clever device. I mean, he's essentially made an island of himself.
Yeah. And would you have been happy to have spoken a bit of Gaelic? Would that have given you pleasure?
Well, I wouldn't be as fluent as some of the others on the job, but I have done a couple of series for TG Garrick before Oscar Gay. But I agree with you. I thought it was very clever, and that immediately hit me.
Well, Sean Moylan, to come to the character that you're currently working on, because it's kind of extraordinary. You're going on stage tonight. What time is the performance at this evening?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. I see.
So I'm on the island. So you might hear seagulls and boats coming in and out in the background.
You're on Whiddy Island at the moment. This is all part of the West Cork Fit Up Festival, and that in itself is a lovely festival. But this man, Sean Moylan, tell us about who he was. He's a huge part to play in the War of Independence, and then subsequently, when the treaty was signed and all the difficulties around that and the subsequent civil war, he found himself in a difficult situation. Give us the pocket version of his history and who he was.
Yeah, I mean, he's extraordinary, I think, in that he had a basic formal education. He was a carpenter, but he educated himself. He was extremely well-read. He made sure that he was fluent in Irish. He was extremely witty and funny. And if you read the transcripts of his Doyle speeches, he was so articulate and so eloquent and almost poetic in his language and getting his point across to politicians who were more experienced in politics and in oration. But yet he got the better of them because he had that kind of an intellect. He's also really conscientious. So I think that the Civil War was a real struggle for him. He was one of the lasting people who tried to the bitter end to find a compromise to avoid it, whereas some of the more radicals on both sides were gung ho. It never sat well with him. And he was also an extremely bright military mind, even though he had no formal military training. He was a brilliant strategist.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The show takes you through all of that from guerrilla and ambush tactics and training to the actual excitement of the ambush themselves, and you feel like you're transported in time. And then he reflects as well. So the premise is that it's Sean Moylan in middle age looking back on the decisions and actions of his youth and how his perceptions may or may not have changed regarding different things.
Now, obviously, he is an interesting character, and as you've described him there, I can see many reasons why you would want to do a one-man show about him and his life. But what specifically, how did you come across the story of Sean Moylan? Because there are lots of leaders of various kinds from that period in time who would be attractive as potential for a one-man show. What attracted you specifically to Sean Moylan?
Well, the connection to Newmarket, my hometown, is the first one, and I had looked at it, and then Sheila O'Sullivan, local historian, brought it to me again, and then I saw it for the second time, and I thought maybe the universe was trying to tell me something. So I listened, and I read more, and the more I read, the more I felt I really need to do this, because he was an unusual man in that, in researching that, I've researched some of the other leaders that were fought in the War of Independence at the same time. And his character is so complex that it's fascinating. And, in researching it, I was really conscious that one person's account of events is not good enough when you're dealing with something this important. And I made sure that I could cross-reference each of his accounts with other members who were present on each one of those ambushes and each of the events that we go through in the play. I just find him to be an endless, the depth of character and the complexity and the conflict, the inner conflict as well, is really interesting, I think.
Yeah,
and when you add that to his charisma and his sense of humour, I think it was tailor-made for this.
Yeah, you do get a sense that he, as well as having to do some of the terrible things he had to do at the time, he was a man who loved a bit of fun and a bit of crack, for sure. But I did wonder, given your own connection, obviously, with Newmarket and his connection with Newmarket, we are dealing with a real person here, and there are descendants of his alive and well. What kind of responsibility did that put on you, Michael?
Yeah, that was the biggest worry I had in the lead up to it, and especially doing research. So I was almost paranoid in my efforts to make sure that I didn't offend the living in trying to honor or examine the actions of the dead. And many of the Moylan descendants, and I know very many of them, there's a lot of them still living in Newmarket, and they're extremely supportive, and I would like to thank them publicly for that. It means a huge amount to me, and it was a huge relief when they liked it so much and when they were so supportive. And Sean Moylan has one living daughter, Eileen, who lives in London, and I sent her a recording of the play, and she seemed to really like it. So yeah, I think that's relief more than anything else that they approved, because that was the most important thing to me.
I can imagine that. But what struck me, I mean, we get Sean Moylan speaking directly to us, and there are times when there are scenes where I presume you're playing more than one character, or you shift into other characters as well, because there are others who tell their stories as well. But what did strike me was a lot of these men who were involved in the flying columns, as they were called at the time, they were ordinary guys who knew little or nothing about war of any kind, way, shape or form. And there are some very amusing stories. I'm thinking in particular of the one, do you remember the one about after an ambush, they ended up taking a bride to her wedding? Do you remember the specifics of that?
Yeah, I mean, they captured two military cars at an ambush at Touring Gar in Northwest Cork. And then they took one of the cars and they hid it. And then Moylan said he hadn't heard it back from the guys who had hidden it. And they had turned out they had taken it to a wedding in Killarney. And Moylan describes Killarney as a town alive with British military black and tans and RAC. And they parked it at the front gates of the cathedral, went into the wedding and headed the wedding procession back out through the town again. So he was, yeah, I think for the most part, he had control over his soldiers, but in this particular instance, he was livid.
Yeah, but I'm sure at the same time, what would they do? They had to get the bride to the church, for heaven's sake. But I think the Bureau of Military History was important for you in particular in your researches finally for this, Michael.
Yeah, and later in his life, he wrote his account of the War of Independence for the Bureau of Military History, and it's there for everybody to read, and not just him, but the other members of his battalion and brigade later on, they also gave their account. So I was able to cross-reference, and that was really useful. But there's also a recording of Sean Moylan on the website as well. And that, of course, gives you a feel for him as a person.
Yeah,
very, very useful. The whole thing is it's a really interesting website. If you go on there, you can read the accounts of most of the leaders who were involved in the War of Independence.
All right. Well, look, you have an hour to go before tonight's performance, so I better let you go and get your head around what you have to get it around before doing that. Thanks so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Michael Patrick. And Sean Moylan, an Irish Revolutionary, is at the West Cork Fit Up Festival this week, 1st through to the 6th of August. Details of that on fit-up.com/theatrefestival.com. It's at Smock Alley in Dublin from the 8th to the 12th of August, and several places around the country: Listowel, Charleville, Watergate Theatre in Kilkenny, Town Hall Theatre in Galway, Town Hall Theatre in Cavan, and the Backstage Theatre in Longford. So lots of opportunities for you to see that. And now, last night on the programme, I spoke to Neil Martin and Ciarán Hines about their Sweeney Song Cycle, based on Seamus Heaney's Sweeney Astray, and that is taking place at this year's Kilkenny Arts Festival. In fact, Kilkenny are centering the work of Seamus Heaney at this year's festival to mark the 10th anniversary of the poet's death. A series of discussions where some of Ireland's leading poets explore Heaney's most celebrated translations will take place during the festival. Fiona Grourke will talk about The Testament of Cressid, Heaney's version of Robert Henryson's tragic poem about Troilus and Cressida, which is set in the aftermath of the Trojan War. Delighted to be joined on the programme this evening by Fiona Grourke. Fiona, it's a wonderful, I was saying this to both Neil Martin and Ciarán Hines last night, it is wonderful that Kilkenny are marking the 10th anniversary of Seamus Heaney's death in the way that they are. How often do you find yourself, and have you found yourself in the last 10 years, thinking or reading the work, thinking about him or reading the work of Seamus Heaney?
Well, Sean, his work would be, I think, fundamental, really, in terms of contemporary Irish poetry. And, you know, he's there as a sort of a bedrock poet and there also as a sort of something to aspire to. So his work, I think, is really crucial. And I think his the sound of his work, the way he constructed a poetry line, a poetry stanza, all of these are very much part of what still gets written in contemporary Irish poetry. So I'd say quite a lot, in fact. Mm.
And a very important aspect of Heaney's work as well has been his translations. I suppose it's safe to say that The Testament of Cressid wouldn't be as well known as some of his other classical work. I mean, I'm thinking of his translation of the final books of the Aeneid that was published subsequent to his death, or indeed his play, The Cure of Troy. Tell me a little bit about this text in particular and why you think Heaney might have wanted to take it on as a translation.
Okay, well, it's I suppose the first thing to say is that this book of the collected translations of Seamus Heaney, which was published earlier this year, gathers in one place translations that came out in various places over the past 30 years. So this one, the Testament of Cressid, was originally published in 2004. In a small edition, and then was published by Faber in 2009. So it's been around for quite a while. Now, you're right, I don't think Robert Henryson is a very familiar poet to a lot of readers. I don't think people will be saying, oh, I wonder, has anybody recently done a translation of Henryson's Testament of Cressid? But I think that it probably, I mean, obviously I can't know for sure why Seamus Heaney took it on, other than what he says in the introduction, but I think there's enough evidence here of what might have interested him to be able to stake a fair enough argument on it. So the first thing I'd say is that when I was reading it, in the back of my mind the whole time was his poem Punishment from his collection North, which is about a bog body. It's about a woman who was punished for some sort of sexual transgression. Mm. That's sort of behind, I think, as a kind of palimpsest, that's behind what's happening in the Testament of Cressid. So what we have with Robert Henryson is he died roughly 1500. Possibly, I was intrigued to read, of diarrhea. He was possibly a lawyer. Certainly he was Scottish, and he wrote in Middle Scots. And this poem of his, The Testament of Cressid, was probably written in or around the 1480s. But it was a text that had been knocking around for quite a while. Mm. So the first iteration of it was by a French poet in the 12th century. And then Boccaccio had a go in the 14th century. Chaucer had his Troilus and Cresside in the 1380s. And then Henryson was 100 years later. And then probably the most famous version, which is really very different, was by Shakespeare in the early 17th century. It's a text that has been there.
And I'll come back to a little bit more about that, the nature of who Henryson might have been writing in 15th century, I think you said, Scotland. But just remind us of the version of the tale that Henryson is telling here. Maybe he's giving us bits of the tale that we hadn't heard.
So what's different about his version from all the other ones, and in particular from Shakespeare? Shakespeare is much more interested in the Trojan War aspect of it, but Henryson is actually interested in Cressid herself. So there's Troilus and Cressida, as Shakespeare called them, or Cressid as Henryson called her. So they're the two, but Henryson is really only interested in Cressid. Troilus is a kind of a bit part player in it. And what he's interested in is this story of a woman who was with Troilus, but who then chose a different man, Diomede, and then he abandoned her, and so she found she kind of fell on hard times and became a camp follower or a kind of prostitute. And then she went home to her father's house. He took her in very kindly, and she lived in seclusion. And one day she was in the temple, and I guess she just got cross about what had happened to her and how low she had fallen. And so she cursed the gods and goddesses. She cursed Venus and Cupid for the fate that had befallen her. And that's when all hell broke loose. And there was a convocation of the gods and goddesses, and they decided to strip her of her beauty, of her voice, of her elegance, of her fame, of everything, and to afflict her with a series of terrible physical punishments, and to make her into a leper. and to have her go and beg in the way that, that lepers did. And so from being this kind of cherished beauty, she became an outcast leper. And so that's the story that Henryson is interested in, which is not the story that any of the others are interested in, really.
Yeah, because I suppose how dare a woman question the gods would be one of the things that maybe Henryson is looking at here that hadn't been looked at before. It was more the sexual transgression of she was betrothed or whatever she was involved with, Troilus, the big general, and then she runs off with a man on the enemy side. She follows her heart. And again, that wouldn't have been an acceptable
thing. Yes, exactly.
It wouldn't have been an acceptable thing. But you mentioned there the deformities that she was given. You have a section, I think, Fiona, that you can read for us, which gives us a sense of, are these Heaney's words now that we're about to hear?
Yes. I'm going to read the Heaney version because Henryson, as I say, he wrote in Middle Scots. And I think it's very much writing that's in an accent, which I think is one of the aspects that possibly really appealed to Seamus Heaney as well,
yeah.
Was this writing in an accent and writing into that accent as opposed to trying to dampen it down or to quieten it in any way. Okay, so let's see. I'm just going to find that page, and here it is. Okay. Your eyes so bright and crystal, I make bloodshot. Your voice so clear, unpleasing, grating, hoarse. Your healthy skin, I blacken, blotch and spot. With livid lumps, I cover your fair face. Go where you will, all men will flee the place. From house to house, you'll travel thus, a leper, begging your way, bearing a cup and clapper. So that's one stanza of the description, but there are several stanzas that describe the horrors that are to be visited upon her.
But the thing that's immediately striking about that, as you read it, Fiona, that's the Seamus Heaney text of the Testament of Cressid. It's the modernity of the language, and yet quite definitely the language of, as you said, that lick of Ulster that Heaney's voice is so well known for, which obviously does reflect that original Scottish version.
Well, one of the things that I found so interesting really about this is looking at the Henryson text, and then on the facing page we have the Heaney one, and just seeing the choices that he's made, which are very close to the surface of the poem. So you can see, for example, where he's decided to swap around the order of the words to give him a different end word, a different rhyme word that sounds more contemporary. And you can see where he's sort of adjusted the iambic pentameter so it doesn't sound so clunkily as it did in the Henryson one. And you can see all of this going on, and it's like watching an incredibly well-oiled machine operating, a beautiful machine operating, seeing all the poetry choices that he makes here. So that's one of the really, I think, pleasurable aspects of the translation, is just almost kind of seeing his mind at work in the translation, because you can see the original and see what he's done with it. So that's one of the really good things, yeah.
And I wonder, to what extent do you feel, I mean, you're saying that Henryson in some way lets us look at this story through the eyes of Cressid rather than through the eyes of Troilus, or indeed Diomede, is that the name of the Greek chap? Does Heaney follow through? Is this in some ways a point of view? Is that point of view of Cressid important in the Heaney translation? Do you think that is driving it in any way?
Well, it's important to say that he does stick very close to the Henryson one. So he doesn't bring in new emphases where they're not there in Henryson. So I think he's very, very interested in the language more than he's interested in the story that the language is telling. But I suppose that would be a standard for a poetry translation. It's funny, Sean. I mean, we're reading it almost 20 years after it was first published in 2004. And of course, an awful lot has happened in terms of sexual politics and gender politics.
Yeah.
And I'd have to say that it's a little bit of an uncomfortable read in one respect, just in terms of the sexual politics of it, because you are kind of thinking, oh gosh, like, why should she be punished so terribly? Why should she be brought so low and be made so dejected for what really seem like very minor transgressions, unless you are somebody who sees things very differently. So there's a slight chafe there, but I think that just says more about what has happened in the intervening years since it was first published than it says about this particular translation.
And funny enough, and you did draw attention to this in the Bog Poems, isn't it? In the Bog Poems where Heaney talks, has a verse that speaks about, "I who have stood dumb when your betraying sisters called and Tar wept by the railings," referring to those, the sexual transgressions of what was then contemporary Northern Ireland, the famous Tar and Feathering, that awful act that went on at the time. In some ways, it seems as if the Cressida story kind of links into that very, very much.
Well, I think so, but because, I mean, in Punishment as well, at the end of that poem, there is a sort of a very strong... He turns his seeing eye back on himself, and it is a very critical moment in the poem, in both senses of the word critical. But he can do that because it's his own poem. But to do that here would be in some way to shimmy out of the Henryson one. So, you know, that's something that he's not doing. He's staying faithful to the Henryson or to the version. So he's not going to step outside and watch himself. Watching the Henryson, if you like. He's too embedded in the original text.
Yeah, but there is a kind of a tragic aspect to the Troilus and Cressid story as well, in this idea that isn't it Troilus who comes back and doesn't recognise Cressid when later on in the poem he just doesn't know who she is. But then there is some kind of rapprochement, if I'm using that word correctly, some kind of peacemaking between the two of them that takes place subsequent to that, which is part of the tragedy. You have a section, I think, that refers specifically to that moment when Troilus sees her.
Yes, I do. It's a very affecting moment, and it's this encounter that is a kind of recognition scene in which they don't recognize each other, but they recognize something, and it's very powerful. Very affecting, and it pulls me back from the idea of total criticism of the text, because it's very sensitive and it does allow both Troilus and especially Cressida, it does allow us to really empathize with them. So this is just a stanza from that section. Upon him then she cast up both her eyes, and at a glance it came into his thought that he sometime before had seen her face, but she was in such state he knew her not. Yet still into his mind her look had brought the features and the amorous sweet glancing of fair Cressid, one time his own, his darling.
There's, and again, something wonderfully modern in that expression of that simple recognition, whatever it was that happened between them. It sounds like it will be a fascinating discussion, Vona, that will be taking place. But thanks for joining us this evening here on the programme.
You're very welcome. Nice to be here. Thanks, Sean.
That's Vona O'Groarc. And Vona will be in conversation with Olivia O'Leary on The Testament of Cressid. That's on Monday, August the 14th at 3 p.m. And on the 16th, Olivia will speak to Mary Clayton on Heaney's Beowulf, the 18th. And Peter Fallon will be speaking on the 18th on Heaney's The Midnight Verdict. So lots of Heaney at the Kilkenny Arts Festival this year. And you'll get full details on kilkennyarts.ie. Born in Amsterdam into a family of musicians, Gwendolyn Mason is a concert violinist, educator and founder and artistic director of the Gaia Music Festival in Switzerland. Together with pianist Finine Collins, she is also co-founder and co-artistic director of the International Master Course, which takes place this week at the National Concert Hall. It's an intensive summer school offering Irish and international aspiring musicians the opportunity to take part in masterclasses and seminars with world-renowned soloists and chamber musicians. Delighted that Gwendolyn Mason is with me in studio this evening. I suppose, Gwendolyn, obviously what you have here are people like yourself, very established professional musicians who are meeting these young Irish musicians. I think there's some international musicians there as well, at a point in their career when they're ready to be shown like very specific tools of the trade. But maybe if we go back to who did that for you at that point in your career? I believe it was Herman Krebers was one of the vital mentors in your life. What did Herman Krebers do for you that you're now trying to do for these young musicians?
I think I got very lucky with my trajectory through being a music student, because I come from this musician's family, and Herman Krebers was the first person outside of my family or outside of that circle of friends that my parents would have been around.
Your father's Ronald Mason, your mother's Maria Kellerman. People will know them from Young European Strings here in Ireland. But your father and your mother both had very fine musical careers in their own right.
They did, yeah, and they do. Thankfully, they're both still working here in Dublin. My mom is still busy with the school. My father is still teaching. And it was amazing to meet somebody outside of that sort of closed unit. And Herman Kleber's, actually, I was teaching a girl from Holland today who is in her early 20s. And Herman Krabbe's passed away nearly 10 years ago. So I tentatively asked her, had she heard of him? Because you never know, you know, time goes fast. And I just, like, you could see the recognition in her eyes, like, oh, like this sort of demigod walking amongst us normal folks. What was amazing about him is that despite his amazing reputation as, the nickname he had was Paganini of the North. He was, at the time of his appointment, the youngest concertmaster of the Concertgebouw Orkest ever at that time.
Which is the big Amsterdam orchestra, really.
It is, yeah. And it's one of, it's been voted relatively recently again as one of the top five orchestras in the world. And he was young. He was 19 or 20 when he got that job. He was only usurped from that age by Jaap van Zweden, who came around 20 years later to sit in the same seat. But by the time I met him, Krebers was deep in his 70s. A phenomenal player. And I expected to see this nearly aloof, conservative person on their pedestal, far away, this, as I say, demigod, with so much experience and having travelled all over the world, worked with the biggest stars. He was one of the last generation to where having a record label meant something, like having a contract with a record label meant something. And I was just amazed that from the very first lesson, I was 12 when I had my first lesson with him. I was shaking like a leaf. I was incredibly nervous. And he was so easy to get on with. He was so congenial. He was so close. He didn't have that aloofness at all. And in the Dutch language, you can have formal and informal. He immediately insisted on informal. And he actually paved the way for not just learning how to play the violin or stand on stage, but he had an ethics around him. He had a moral compass that I hadn't expected somebody of his stature to have, and he passed that on.
And I guess you're touching on something there. Yes, you were 12 at the time, but you were a very talented 12-year-old. And in terms of the technicalities that somebody like Herman, or indeed yourself now with these young musicians and your compatriots, the musicians that are with you on other instruments, you giving the violin being your primary instrument, that there's something that I don't know how much technique somebody like that is going to teach you, that it, in fact, is it about going somewhere else that they open you up to seeing the music in your way, as opposed to trying to say, no, you don't put your finger there in that fashion. That's incorrect. It's not that type of teaching. That's not what we're talking about.
No. I'm trying to move away from that. I know that, first of all, there's a time and a place.
So yeah, you have to learn the technique. You can't ignore it.
No, absolutely not. But we have a week, so we're limited in what we can give. And we see the students quite right. We see them every day. And most of us will give 3 to 5 lessons to them individually. But that's still a very contained amount of time. It's very little time. So the thing that's changed primarily in how we would like to approach this to how it might be approached elsewhere is that there's a sense of a flat hierarchy. There isn't this sort of pedestal behaviour where, you know, you've got the person who's very established and then you've got a younger person who's to look up to that person. The idea is actually to just talk on eye level and ask them, what do you need? What can I give you?
It is the same music that the well-established person is playing as the young person starting out on their career. They're looking at the same dots on the same page.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've so little time that I do ask them, is there something I can help you with? Some of them are very forthcoming, some aren't. Some are very good at communication, some are less. But you've got those 5 hours. And what I've learned actually is that if you can click in that first sort of meeting, you can really open something up, not just for the student, but you can also discover things as a teacher for yourself. And that's actually what has, for sure, for me anyway, from the very beginning, I realized this idea of teacher and student, where one is placed on a pedestal and the other isn't. That's not true the experience.
Well, all good teachers say you learn as much as you teach.
Absolutely.
I want to play a little bit of Horace Toccata, which is a very well-known violin piece, but this particular version of the piece, first of all, tell us, is Georges, is Georges Dinicou, is it Georges, or am I giving him
Gregory?
This piece is kind of often an encore and a bit of fun, but you've done something different with it in this recording, which involves young players.
Absolutely. I've done this actually for the last 10 years or so. I love working with people who are in the middle of their studies or just finishing their studies, where there's this energy around them and this readiness to explore things. And they're not jaded. Mm. They haven't been sitting the same job for many years, kind of going, oh, whatever. They still get excited about things. And that energy and then the time that you have to work with them, first of all, it changes your own outlook on it. And in the piece you're talking about, it is actually just, in quotation marks, just a violin piano piece. But we open it up for string ensemble. And we invited Miklós Lukács, who is a wonderful cymbalom player from Hungary, who I know from childhood, to come in and give that authenticity, which isn't actually marked in the score, but to give that authenticity that you'd expect from that music, that flavour.
Less of a listen to it. It really opens the piece up in a whole new way to me, anyway. I wanted to get to that. I'm calling it the dulcimer, I call it the zither, I'm calling it all sorts of things. But the Hungarian version is called the cymbalom.
And
beautiful. And you can see in that you were having a lot of fun with those younger students. Two aspects I want to mention just before we finish up. As well as these master musicians like yourself and your colleagues that will be giving the master classes, you've also involved people just out of college to mentor these young people who are not out of college yet.
That's right. And we're literally talking about people who are 2 weeks fresh off their graduation master's recitals. I think one of the things that will help for young people to identify with this music business is to actually have a chance to connect with students close to them in age, where they know that they have had similar experiences, speak a similar language, but they can pass something on. Mm. And at the same time, Ireland's a small island, and nearly every musician who wants to live solely from being a musician ends up having to leave to get studies abroad opportunities.
You need people to give them the guidelines on that. Now, people can attend these concerts. There will be masterclasses over the next days. NCH.ie, is that the best place to find out?
NCH is where you can find all the information on this.
Okay. I'm sorry we have to finish so quickly, but we're right out of time. The International Master Course started today at the National Concert Hall in Dublin. Runs through until Sunday the 6th. Daily Observer tickets and concert tickets all available on NCH.ie. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. I'm Dean Paso Devine and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Aisling Crofty was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night, 6:30 on RT Radio 1. John Creedon is on the way.